So today, His Holiness has started here in Sera Thekching Ling, which historically has been an institution for a well-known institution for academic institution for study of the Dharma and philosophy and so forth. And as part of the here at Sera Che Dazong's debate courtyard, where a large number of people, both monastics and monastics as well as lay people, have gathered here. You have come here spending lots of money, and despite all problems and difficulties, you have taken interest and come here. And I would like to greet you all. And with all your faith and devotion, you have come here. So since you have come here with great interest, I am very happy also to see you. So this time, the purpose of gathering here, the goal is, last year we started the Lamrim, guided teachings of Lamrim. We started with the eight texts, the great guided teachings. And then on top of that, we have added other number of texts, making up 11 different texts, of which I have received the instructions transmission. And so some of the texts we have already finished last year. And this time we will we have the text such as the refined essence of refined gold. And I will try to cover as many texts as possible. I don't know if I can finish all the texts. And so, and if I push myself too hard, I may also hurt my eyes. And so I will try my best to finish as many texts as possible. The purpose of our gathering here today is that this life to draw some benefit in this life and to have a way of thinking which is beneficial for you or yourselves in this life. If you can do that, then it would be a guarantee for you to have a good life in the next. If you live a bad life, evil life, and even if at the time of around the time of death, if you may do some prayers and offerings of lamb, butter lambs, and so forth, and it may be very difficult to help yourselves. But if you live a meaningful life now, then it's quite sure that you will be able to help yourself in the next life. And so we are gathered here for this Dharma discourse. So first, in the beginning, we will say the verse of taking refuge in bodhicitta, three times together, the Lama and the disciples together. So the purpose of this recitation is whatever Dharma discourse we engage in, we undertake, we need to have the right motivation. So whatever activities, whatever things we do with our bodies, speech, and mind, whether it becomes a virtuous one or non-virtuous one, depends on our motivation. So externally, you may appear to be doing some kind of Dharma practice or prayers and also making offerings and so forth. But if your motivation is tinged with the eight worldly concerns, then your practice practices do not become a Dharma practice. But on the contrary, if you, with the right motivation, with a pure motivation, if you do whatever practice you do, then it will become a virtuous one. It will become a Dharma practice. And so for the Dharma in general and for the practice of Mahayana, the Dharma, to become a Dharma practice or Mahayana practice, it has to be influenced by the right motivation. And so whatever motivation, whatever practice you do, you need to do them with the right motivation accordingly. And so from this, on the part of the Lama, with the intention to benefit the disciples and others, and one should teach you, and then you, the audience who are gathered here, you should also bear the right motivation, the pure, untainted motivation while you listen to the teaching. So what kind of motivation are we talking about? We need the take the principle of taking refuge, which distinguishes one from the wrong path, and then the bodhicitta, which distinguishes us from the lower path. We should have this kind of motivations of taking refuge and bodhicitta. If you do that, then your action of listening to the teaching will be effective. While sitting here, wearing the robes and so forth, if you, for example, on me, regarding me, if my intention or motivation is tinged with the wrong kind of motivation, then I will be accumulating non-virtues or creating evil actions. And so, so from the side of the Lama, I need to be able to teach you in accordance with the tradition that has come down through Master Nagarjuna and Master Tsongkhapa and so forth. And with this right kind of motivation, I will be able to do the teaching in the right way. And from the on the part of the disciples, you in the audience, you should also have the right motivation to listen to the teachings and to make transformation within yourselves, and with that kind of right motivation, and the Dharma teaching that you are attending will be effective. Otherwise, if you just think of making money or try to become a teacher to somebody and so forth without really having the right motivation, then it would be tantamount to creating negative action. And so, with regard to any kind of teaching religious traditions, we have the practice of taking refuge in, for example, in the theistic religions, they take refuge in the God, the Creator. And also the non-theistic ones have their own founder teachers as well. And so we all take refuge in our founding teachers. So with regards to Buddhism now, Chandrakirti has said that the three refuges of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha are the refuges for those who aspire to liberation. Liberation. And so with regard to moksha or liberation, it is not the Buddhist moksha or liberation is not like something like what the Jains believe in, some kind of a place that you reach. But it is the elimination of all kinds of shortcomings that are within ourselves, limitations and so, in other words, there are two levels of moksha. One is the total elimination of all the delusions, the negative emotions, and then also another level where you have eliminated all defilements from within one's mind. In other words, both the obscurations. And so, the Buddha is the teacher who has taught selflessness. The teacher of selflessness. And then with regard to the Dharma, which comprise the true path and true cessation. And so from once you attain these two within yourself, then you will be someone who has attained the true object of refuge within oneself, which is the realization of emptiness directly, and also the realization and the attainment of cessation, a true cessation within oneself. And so, having realized both of these, the cessation and true path within oneself, we have great beings whom we take as our role models, not because of their wealth or their power and authority, but so we as monastics are called aspirants of virtue, and so we aspire to virtue and actually trample the eight worldly concerns and totally focus our body, speech, and mind, dedicate our body, speech, and mind for liberation. And so, therefore, as it is said by Chandrakirti, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha are the refuges for those aspiring liberation. So if you take refuge merely for some benefit in this life, then once you die from this life, then the effect is over. And if you also wish to have something good in the next life and take refuge, then the result is ends there once you attain a higher rebirth in the next life. And also, if you take refuge with the intention to reach nirvana, once you reach that goal, is done. And here what we are talking about is taking refuge within the understanding of the Mahayana path and in order to reach complete Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. So once you attain a state where you have eliminated all delusions, all defilements from within your mind, then you have reached the great enlightenment, the full enlightenment of Buddhahood. So when you say, I take to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, I take refuge until I'm enlightened. What you are saying is that until you reach that great enlightenment of Buddhahood, you will take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Now, in order to reach the final and ultimate cessation and path within yourself, which must come through the means that you apply and integrate within yourself, thereby overcoming the shortcomings and the faults within yourself and progressing yourself, spiritually making progressing further and further. And so when we think about benefiting all sentient beings, we don't just take refuge in the Buddha who is able to benefit all sentient beings limitlessly, infinitely, and so forth, but we also take refuge in the sense that we aspire to become a Buddha in the end. So just as the Buddha Shakyamuni, for example, first generated bodhicitta, then engaged in the accumulation of the two, the merit and wisdom, and then finally became enlightened. Likewise, and also Muslim Master Nagarjuna and so forth of the Indian lineage, and also the masters of Tibetan Buddhist traditions, Gelug Sakyan Nyingma Kagyu and Jonang. And so, they all have engaged in the six perfections of the practices of bodhisattvas, and also the tantric practices come under the bodhisattva practice. And so, they have all these past masters have either become enlightened through these practices, or they are still engaging in these practices. And therefore, when you say to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, I take refuge until I'm enlightened, this is the sense that you have to get, that you want to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings, to that you take refuge in them, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, to become enlightened in the end. And then, by the accumulations I create through generosity and so forth. Sometimes we find mentioned by the merit I create through generosity and so forth. This is not inclusive when you say merit alone. In order to be inclusive, we should use the term accumulation. By the accumulations I create through generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha to benefit all beings. Of course, with the understanding of what Buddhahood or Bodhi actually means, if you engage in your practices, then of course it also will include the aspect of wisdom as well. So when you say this prayer, the verse, you come across the term I, and I go for refuge until enlightenment, and by the accumulations created through generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha to benefit on sentient beings. You come across these I's. One should actually bring up in your mind, that this self that you are focusing on, the I, does not exist the way it appears to you, as if it has some kind of independent existence. And similarly, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, the Sangha, and all the sentient beings and yourself are merely designated on the basis of your aggregates. And so with this understanding of selflessness, when you say, I take refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you should have this idea in your mind that this I does not have any objective independent existence. And similarly, by the accumulations I create through generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha to benefit sentient beings. You should have that same sense of the lack of independent existence of yourself, or Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and also the sentient beings for whose sake you are generating bodhicitta within yourself. And so the profound view of Madhyamaka, or the middle way, we all are familiar with this term of the view of Madhyamaka, or the middle way. And all these understanding, the knowledge that you have gained, you must be able to actually bring them to practice, in your practice. And so, by the accumulations I create when you say this, then it actually includes both the merit and wisdom, accumulations of merit and wisdom. And so, all of us, me as the teacher here, and you as the disciples in the audience, please have this in mind and say this prayer. To the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, I take refuge until I'm enlightened. By the accumulations I create through the generosity and so forth, may I become Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Second time. To the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Assembly, I take refuge until I'm enlightened. By the accumulations I create through generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. To the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, I go for refuge until I am enlightened. By the accumulations I create through generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So this is calling on all the gods, goddesses, and non-gods, and humans to come here and to listen to this holy Dharma teaching, which eliminates all the negative emotions, which is worthy to listen to. I give this teaching in the languages of the humans, gods, asuras, and so forth. I pay homage to the Gotama, who out of his compassion gave this holy teaching to rid us of all distorted views. So here, people from many different countries have come to listen to this Lamrim teaching. Some of these countries are those which where Buddha Dharma has never not flourished in the past. You have not, people have not heard Dharma in the past. And then also, and others are those who are traditionally Buddhist. So there are 10 different languages which into which this teaching is being translated, interpreted. So the purpose of our gathering here, not for some kind of a show and entertainment, nor to make money. You only have to spend money and you can't gain money by coming to this teaching. If the monastic community here, assembly here, were smaller, perhaps the monks and nuns would get more money. Each of them would get more money. But here is huge assembly of monastics, so you may not get much money. And so sometimes people come here for the purpose of making money to... It's wrong. And sometimes people say that, oh, His Holiness is teaching somewhere and therefore we must go to make money and do business. So you have not come here to make money nor to for some kind of entertainment show. So there may be some people who have come here saying that, oh, if I go to this teaching, I will see His Holiness Dalai Lama. So this is not how we go about with the Dharma. The Buddha himself has taught that 84,000 teachings of the Buddha, teachings, and in the Tibetan translation we have the over 100 volumes of the teachings of the Buddha. So what they teach is what are our faults, this undisciplined mind, and what actually makes us our mind undisciplined. And if we are, what happens if our mind is undisciplined? If we discipline our mind, what is the benefit of it? And so, by seeing the pros and cons of this disciplined, undisciplined mind, we need to think about disciplining the mind, taming and subduing our mind. It's not through by asking some kind of a prayer from the Buddha or blessing from the Buddha or the monastic community or the Dalai Lama. So I'm a follower of the Buddha, and I need to find the means to counter the undisciplined states of mind that I have, and then I need to find the means to do that. So your mind undisciplined is made undisciplined by this self-cherishing attitude and grasping at a true existence. Until now, what we have done is we have completely given in to these two, considering them as our true sworn friends, true friends, and we have given ourselves into them. And then the result is what we are now. So since this is the case, we need to actually combat and oppose these two. So to use a modern term, we need to be revolutionary. So how do we actually combat these two negative states of mind? So if you actually apply the teaching within yourself and then go on like that when you have spent one decade, two or three, four decades, then you will see that there is some change. And so, in order to reach self-cherishing attitude, we need bodhicitta. So this is the foundation for fulfilling all temporary as well, short-term and as well as long-term goals. And so, bodhicitta is the countermeasure to self-cherishing attitude. And so it is taught very well in Bodhisattva Charya Avatara by Shantideva. If you actually read it and then use your mind to understand it, you'll see and how the bodhicitta, actually the explanation of bodhicitta that Shantideva gives, actually can make this self-cherishing attitude dumbfounded. So, of course, when you practice bodhicitta, it is not just to say that you are making yourself holy, but then you are actually dedicated for the benefit of others. As Jajang Puja says, while with this kind of attitude, you are determined to help serve other sentient beings. Your own interest is fulfilled as a byproduct. And so, as we usually recite the Heart Sutra, where it says the five aggregates also are empty of inherent nature, and then form is empty, emptiness is form, and so forth. We all recite this, not only Tibetans, the Heart Sutra, the Chinese, also, the Japanese, as Vietnamese, Koreans, the Buddha, Koreans, brothers and sisters, and of course Mongolians and the Russian, the Mongolian ethnic Mongolians in the Russian Federation also do recite this. So since the Heart Sutra is well known to us, we should actually use this to develop this understanding of selflessness or emptiness as taught in the Heart Sutra, where it says form is empty, sound, there's no sound, no order, and so forth. And use the understanding of selflessness, emptiness, to counter our grasping at true existence. So with making offerings and doing prostrations and doing prayers, recitations will not help. Of course, it may be helpful to accumulate some merit, but then so just by cherishing others, this love or loving-kindness does not counter the self-cherishing, the extreme self-cherishing attitude, this grasping at self, at independent existing self. And so the study of Parchin is meant for developing this cherishing others, the bodhicitta. And then the Madhyamaka studies that we do is meant for understanding selflessness. Of course, where selflessness is taught according to the different traditions, different Buddhist philosophical traditions. But the selflessness or the view of the correct view that we are talking about is as taught in the Heart Sutra, where it says the five aggregates are empty of inherent nature and the form is empty, emptiness is form, and so forth. So we need to understand selflessness thoroughly based on the study of Madhyamaka texts. So far, we have actually deceived ourselves, ruined ourselves, caused ourselves all kinds of problems because of the self-cherishing attitude and grasping at true existence of self. And therefore, what we need to do now is to develop bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness by using this human intelligence and make this life that we have gained now a meaningful one. And so all the teachings that we are going to deal with, undertake here, is meant for developing these two principles. I also do this on a daily basis, and it's really helpful, and it keeps me happy and physically healthy. And then even though I'm amidst lots of problems, difficulties, deep down I always am able to keep my calm mind. And this comes through training of mind. And in order to train one's mind, you need actually to know. You need to have gained conviction about the practice, conviction in the practices themselves. And it's not just the text that says this, but you need to actually read the text, study them, and reflect on them. And then for that, you need to listen to the teaching. And so the Lam Rim teaching is meant for how we should go about with transforming our mind. So first of all, here we have people from Israel gathered here. from many different countries. About 30,000 people are gathered here, I'm told. So broadly speaking, these 30,000 people gathered here, so we are part of the 7 billion people on this planet. All the 7 billion people do not want suffering and want happiness. Everyone is same in that sense. But then, as said in Shantideva's Bodhicharyavata, Bodhisattvacharyavatarai, though not wanting suffering, they run after suffering. Though wanting happiness, they destroy it as if destroying their enemy. And so this is what we do. This all 7 billion people do not want. So His Holiness uses the term human beings with hair, but perhaps I should not say human beings who have hair on their head, but because there are people who are bold, including me. So Gadendra Rinpoche still has hair on his head, so let me consider you as the king of all the people gathered here, all human beings. And so everyone wants happiness, wants to achieve happiness and overcome suffering, but then we're not able to achieve the goal. If you listen to the news, if you listen, read newspapers, and if you if you meet with people, although everything looks very nice externally, as the Seventh Dalai Lama says, whoever we look at, male, female, and so forth, we all are same in the same boat, that we are all suffering beings. Although we have different appearances, living, wearing different costumes, having different professions, some have high salary, some have low salary, and so forth. Although we have all kinds of people, varieties of people, but then 90% of people are have a disturbed state of minds. They appear minds of disturbed, and many of them just live very idle life, a naughty life. So all of us, as human beings, we do not want suffering, but want happiness. But regarding happiness or joy, there is a physical aspect of it, which is similar to the animals, which are based on sensorial experiences. And so based on the sensorial experiences, even animals do things to avoid suffering and gain happiness. But then there's another layer of happiness, which is mainly based on, which is drawn on the basis of using our mind. So, of course, even animals do, to some degree, do that. But as human beings, we have more intense kind of pain and pleasure, unlike animals, because of our thought process, that all kinds of thinking and preconceptions that we have. And because of hopes and fears, we have more suffering, anxiety, fear. And when you are full of these experiences, then you lie, you deceive others, abuse, and you actually become hypocritic. Even a lama, for example, if he or she is full of hopes and fears, then they would pretend to be knowing what they don't know, and then tell lies to others. And so, by thinking of oneself with selfish attitude, then we are full of hopes and fears, and then all kinds of problems ensue from there. I was in Mexico recently, and when I was there, nearby the Mexico City itself, in the suburbs, there was a pontificate university, and a seminary, Christian seminary school. They invited me And I was asked to give a talk, and I actually said very honestly that many of us who are practitioners of the different religions, actually, I mean, we have these different robes to wear. But while we are wearing the robes, I said, we appear to be very holy as a practitioner. And then one of the bishops who said that he was who was told me to be someone who is socially active, helping poor people. And so next day he came to see me, and he told me that we as practitioners of the religions, we are religious people, it's for us, it's very, very important to be very practical about our teachings, to help others. And so what you said, he said to me, what you said was very true. And so when everything is going right, there's no problem, then we may appear to be good practitioners. But when you are actually faced with challenges, then you will show your true color. So many of us are in this kind of situation, perhaps. So even if you may be in robes, monastics, if you are full of fears and hopes and desires and so forth, it's better to leave the robes and live as a layperson while wearing the robes. But you want to live like the lay people, and it's a disgrace to the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha itself. So the Buddha said that my Dharma will not be destroyed from outside, it will be destroyed from inside, like a lion, which is a lion, which is actually eaten by bugs from inside. And so the monastics must remind themselves that they are monks or nuns, and they are followers of the Buddha, and therefore must follow the Buddha's teaching sincerely. And you should not take example of people who are doing all sorts of things. And so don't think that there are people who do all sorts of things, therefore I can also do the same. So this is wrong. You are deceiving yourselves. So you should be careful. So when I meet with Westerners, I'm not being nice to them. I speak frankly with them. So wherever I am, like in this kind of gathering in front of Tibetan communities, I speak honestly. I speak as a human being and not as the Dalai Lama or the Buddhist. I tell people that if I have this attitude that I am the Dalai Lama or I am a Tibetan, I am a Buddhist and so forth. For example, when I meet with Christians and other religious people, if I think that I am a Buddhist, then it actually distances me from the others. And then there is some kind of cautiousness that I have to, and caution that I have to take. And then if I think that I am the Dalai Lama, then I should, I would have to pretend to be dignified and so forth. So I don't like this. I don't do these. If I think that I'm a holy person, I'm the Dalai Lama, I create a prison around me and I'm a prisoner. And therefore, I become very cautious, to the point that I may not be able to even walk properly in front of people. And so, I always consider others to be same as myself on the level of being human being. So, on this level, then I can share my experiences and thoughts and so forth, and it will be helpful to others. So, the time is over for us to be formal. And so we have done this for centuries in Tibet. And where are we now today? So we have not been practical, and it doesn't help to pretend. So we all don't want suffering, want happiness. And therefore, the pain and pleasure that we are talking about here is mainly the pain and pleasure based on our mind, on the mental level, not the physical, sensorial levels. So all sentient beings, we need to, as human beings, we need to use and make this human intelligence worthy Therefore, I always tell people to be moral, to practice moral ethics, and to have warm heart, which is the root, the foundation of one's own happiness. If you are honest, be warm-hearted, and don't harm others, and be sincere, and then you also are very relaxed. You don't need to be hypocritical, doing something in front and doing something else. You don't need to be special, superficial. If you can be transparent, then you don't need to be cautious. Because then you will not have fear. Because when you have doubt and suspicion, then you have fear, and then that leads to anger. So if you have no fear or anxiety, then your mind will be relaxed, at ease. So whether you are a believer or non-believer, doesn't matter. But I always tell people that we need to be good people. I always tell this. Of course, with animals, we can't do much. We, as human beings, we can think a lot. Unlike animals, and we have languages, we have different scripts, letters. So this human intelligence that we have, with which we can discern things, if we can use it to bring about happiness, it's good, it's meaningful, it's wise. If we actually use it to cause ourselves more problems, then it's foolish. So the first thing that we need to do is to be warm-hearted, to be honest, not superficial. And then, regarding the believers, I have seen a report where it said that out of the 7 billion people, 1 billion are non-believers. So as I said earlier, they also do not want suffering, but want happiness. So even though they do not believe in religion, but to have a happy life in this life, if they can actually learn about the workings of our mind, the system of working of our mind, then they will be able to draw happiness. So when I say this, many people actually admire and like this. And many scientists also, my colleagues, my comrades, they also have the same opinion that, like me, that we lack interest in paying attention to the mind. And so we need to pay attention to this hygiene of mind. And then the 6 billion, remaining 6 billion people are said to be believers. And within the believers, of course, they have religions which have some philosophical ground. The largest number of people following religion are maybe Christians. Maybe there are 1 billion. And then Muslims also 1 billion plus, and Muslims about 1 billion. And then out of 7 billion, 1 billion plus are Christians, 1 billion or so maybe Muslims, and then Hindus, 500 million, and then the Buddhists, maybe 500 million. And so these are the main religious traditions. So the followers of these religions are the followers of major religious traditions. So there are, of course, other religions which are which worship just nature, like sun, moon, or some kind of nature, or spirits, and so forth. And so people may talk about being under the negative influence of this or that spirit and so forth. I mean, they do not have much philosophical ground in them. But all the major religious traditions of this world are and have philosophical background or grounding. So even the non-theistic religion, I mean theistic religions like Hinduism and Islam and Christianity and so forth, they also emphasize the practice of love and compassion. One of my Muslim friends has said that if you are true Muslim, there's no way you can actually harm others. He said that Allah is said to be our creator. And therefore, as much as you have respect for and admiration, or you give in to Allah, and to that extent, you also respect others, all the creatures of Allah. And so, all religions teach warm heart. And therefore, as they also recognize and acknowledge the obstacles that hinder the practice of love and compassion, and therefore they teach forgiveness, all the religious traditions. And when you become very greedy, that also hinders and is a fault in terms of in the practice of love and compassion, and therefore they teach contentment. And since there are all kinds of problems and faults in the mind, then all the religious traditions also teach self-discipline. So you can see that all the religious traditions are health beneficial to all to humanity. If they have not been helpful, these religious traditions won't be here. So although in this 21st century where we have very high advancement in technology and science, but we still have these religions. So while they have the same message, they have different philosophical views. And different philosophical views are actually there to boost our practice and cultivation of love and compassion. And so the theistic religions say that everything is created by God, and therefore the God being infinite love, therefore we need to also show love towards the creatures, all creatures of God, the Creator, and therefore we must not harm them. And so these different philosophical grounds or philosophical teachings are to give us conviction and aspiration to practice love and compassion, and to promote and boost it further, them further. So I always say that we should keep our faith in one's own religious tradition that one follows, whereas we should respect all the religious traditions of the world, which have different philosophy. So the first point is to be a good person, to live a good life, an honest life. So this is something that we have in Tibetan community. We are not praising ourselves, of course, but people who are acquainted with Tibetans, who are familiar or who have met with Tibetans and have actually witnessed Tibetans' way of life, many of them actually praise the Tibetans for being honest and not lying. And many Westerners, foreigners who visit Tibet say this, and also Chinese who visit Tibet. Although Tibetans are suffering in Tibet, I met one time a Chinese. A reporter told me that he went to Lhasa from Beijing by train. And on the train, it of course may have taken a few days from Beijing to Lhasa. And what he told me that he witnessed that the Tibetans were very humble and moral, and they smile all the time. And so this is something many Chinese tell me. So this is our pride that we should be proud of. But these days, I hear that there are more and more Tibetans who are lying telling lie. In America, there are those Tibetans in America and Europe. So we have to be very careful. We should be able to preserve the values that we have, the things that are worthy that are with us. If we neglect them and if they decline, it's very sad. So this is, it's very important to preserve them. So in Tibet, there are people from the Western countries, other countries, and Chinese as well. And so, I mean, so I have been hearing from these visitors that these days, even in Tibetan rural areas, there are people who sell things on a very high price to these Westerners and Chinese. So we have here people from Tibet in the teaching. And so this, the Chinese and the Westerners have told me that in some places, Tibetans actually are covetous to make more money, and therefore they actually sell things on expensive, on high prices. And so some Chinese travel agencies seem to be actually preferring Chinese tourist guides. And these tourist guides are purposely instructed that the Tibetans are very greedy, and Tibetans are very naughty, and Tibetans kill people, and so forth. After actually having been instructed so, then they actually, when they actually guide tourists in Tibet, then these guides actually inform the tourists such things. And actually, when these tourists see the Tibetans misbehaving, and then they could actually confirm what the guides have told them. So this is something which we must be very careful. We have some dignity in the eyes of people. And if we lose this, of course, we will also lose support from people who support our cause. And so we have to be very careful. And then those who are religious should also practice love and compassion, be honest and helpful to others. And this is second level. And then on the third level, we're Buddhists. So amongst all the religious traditions of the world, and the teaching of dependent origination or interdependent nature of things is only found in the teaching of the Buddha. It's unique to Buddhism. Of course, in Hinduism, there is teaching of causality, that things come about through causes and conditions. But then, when it comes to the experiencer of creator of these causes and conditions, the karma and experience of the result, then these other traditions, religious traditions, believe in some kind of independently existent self or atma or soul. And so Buddhism is the only religious tradition which asserts, which teaches selflessness. And so from the point of view of the philosophical view, Buddhism is that which rejects self. And the other non-Buddhist traditions are those which assert a selfhood or atma or soul. And so I usually say that the essence of Buddhism is twofold. The philosophical understanding dependent origination and the ethical conduct of non-violence or not harming others. So the practice, when it comes to the ethical conduct, then it is non-violence, which is common to all religious traditions as well. And as to back up this conduct, practice of the ethical conduct, we have the teaching of selflessness or the dependent origination in Buddhism. In Kamala Shila's commentary on Chandrakshita's Tattu Samgraha, so Kamala Shila says in his Tattu Samgraha Panjika, that based on the law of causality. So Jerem Buche also has mentioned in his Gongpa Rapsil three different kinds of dependence. One is dependence on causality, then other is the dependence on designated dependence, and then the merely nominal designation. So, Buddhism as a whole believes in the law of causality, that things come about through causes and conditions. So this dependent origination is something which is common to all the Buddhist systems. So this is something which is very called scientific as well, compatible with science. So since I have had this kind of connection, relation with scientists, it's been 30 years, over 30 years, and one of the scientists at our last 26th Mind and Life Conference told us, didn't he, that he was not a Buddhist, but he actually believes in the past and future lives. So such people actually who are discerning and use reasoning and call it, they actually admire the teaching of the Buddha. So I usually say that the teaching of dependent origination, and I usually say that the non-violence that we find in Buddhism is related with world peace. And so if people ask you what Buddhism is about, you should be able to answer by saying that Buddhism is about the teaching of Buddhism is twofold, which are the non-violence and which is the ethical conduct, and then the philosophical view is dependent origination. So please keep this in mind, you who have come from Tibet also, and you can answer in this way to people. So nonviolence doesn't mean that while you keep a ill will within yourself, but do something nice externally, that doesn't mean to be nonviolence. So you should be totally compassionate, and whatever you do, you should do it sincerely without any ulterior motive. And so if you are compassionate, then your action, physical and verbal actions, will be also non-violent. So the non-violence here doesn't mean being passive, that you are unable to do anything, helpless. But it means that while you have, even if you may have the opportunity to harm somebody, to hurt somebody, you still restrain doing that. That is non-violence. So that is rooted in compassion. And also the dependent origination, the understanding of dependent origination. So please, all of you, keep this in mind. And so this is a general a presentation of how Buddhists should act. And so Buddha appeared in this world 2,600 or something years ago. And then he became Buddha, and then he became a self-ordained, and then gave teachings, and the then there is he gave teachings which are today spread in all different countries like Burma, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Cambodia, and Laos, Tibet, China, and so forth. So all of us, whether we are followers of the Hinayana or Mahayana, we have this common practice of Vinaya, the monastic or the ethical discipline. So some years ago, I attended the World Religious Parliament. So the first was held in Chicago, and then in other countries also it was held. And then one time it was held in Australia, in Melbourne. And so two Burmese monks have also come there, and they had said that they wanted to see me. And so, of course, generally, the practitioners of Buddhism in Burmese Buddhists have very good practice of shamatha and vinaya, on the, while they are based on founded on this vinaya practice. So I really respect them, and so as these two monks expressed their wish to meet me, I went to see them wearing this yellow robe. And then we had discussion, and at the discussion, these two monks told me that we are followers of the same Buddha, but we have many differences. And so I got this suspicion that they were actually referring to the Lamaism, which is a term that people have given to Tibetan Buddhism, and as if the Tibetan Buddhism is not real, true Buddhism, but it is something which is mixed with Hinduism, and especially Tantra. And one reason why Tibetan Buddhism is called Lamaism is because when people hear that such person is a lama or tulku, then they tend to respect them, whereas when they are told that such and such person is a geshe or some scholar or some monk, they don't pay that kind of respect. So I just had this, I wondered if they were actually referring to this kind of things. So when I met the late Nelson Mandela, after he became the president of South Africa, we came out of the president's office, and we had a media conference, and he introduced me to the media, saying that he said the Dalai Lama is the head of the Lamaism, and Lamaism is good. And so he had that concept of Lamaism in his mind. And so I also I thought when I met these two Burmese monks said that we have great big differences. And so I responded by saying, yes, we have differences, but the main thing is that in order to practice the Buddha Dharma, we need to be founded on the Vinaya practice, the discipline. So with regard to discipline, you follow the Theravada tradition, and we Tibetans follow the Mula Sarvastivada tradition. We have 253 vows following the in the Pali tradition, the Padmoksha vows are less in number, 220 or something. So I actually took interest in them, paid attention, studied them. And so with regards to the four defeats and 13 remainders, and then the downfalls to remediate, regarding these three sets of vows, there is not much difference. But with regards to the some other sets of vows, for example, vows which talk about how to wear one's robes, there is a difference in our tradition. There are 7 points mentioned as to how one should wear the lower garment, lower robe. In the Pali tradition, it's only mentioned that one should wear the lower garment properly. So there's only one precept. So after having informed them about our Vinaya practice in detail like this, then they were quite surprised and told me, "Oh, you also have such practices." So otherwise, when people see that people are wearing some strange robes and have matted locks on their hair and then have wives, I mean, this is found to be something quite strange. So if we could make the 3 practices of monastics, the bi-monthly confession, and then the summer retreat and the end of summer retreat and so forth, these practices clear, then we will be able to actually make the point clear that we are also followers of the same Buddha. And then when it comes regarding the Mahayana, in Mahayana Sutra Alamkara, Maitreya talks about mentions the great qualities of Mahayana. It's not about despising the Hinayana as such, because if you despise the Hinayana path, it is considered to be a transgression of vows when we practice Mahayana. And so, for a practitioner of Mahayana, the practice of Vinaya, the practice of moksha vow and so forth, which are found even in the Hinayana tradition, must serve as a foundation. So they also have the practice of Vinaya, and then the cultivation of the 37 harmonies of enlightenment. And then we have in the Mahayana, the main teachings are the teachings of the perfection of wisdom, in which there are 2 contents. The subject matter, the explicit one is emptiness, and the implicit one is the progression along the path. And so Maitreya's texts, like Abhisamaya Alamkara and so forth, deal with this explicit or implicit content of the Prajaparamita Sutras. Whereas, and then following him, there are masters like Asanga and so forth who have written commentaries. And then we have the explicit content of the perfection of wisdom teaching, the sutras, which are explicated further by Master Nagarjuna and his lineage. So this lineage is called the profound lineage, and then the other one is called the extensive lineage, lineage of conduct. And so these are the 2 lineages that have come from that have come down to us from based on the Prajaparamita sutras. And then with regard to the third turning of the wheel of the Dharma, the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma is the perfection of wisdom teachings. We have the teachings of the Sandhi Nimochana Sutra and then also the Tathagata Garbha Sutra. Which has become the root text for Maitreya's Mahayana Uttara Tantra. So there is one verse which is found in both the Abhisamaya Alamkara and the Mahayana Uttara Tantra. The one which is found in the Abhisamaya Alamkara may be understood from the point of view of the emptiness, the nature of emptiness of the mind, whereas what is referred in the Mahayana Uttara Tantra may be understood to be the subjective mind, the clear light mind. So this is my view, my opinion. Not sure about it. And so in this, there is mention of the 9 analogies and then 9 points relating to them. And so, what is taught is that the defilements are temporary, adventitious, and the nature of mind, the basic nature of mind is clear light. On the basis of these two teachings, what we see is the possibility of overcoming the negative emotions or the defilements that are within our mind stream. And then the clear light nature of the mind itself, when it is, where there is this quality of cognition and awareness and clarity, we have that potential for attaining the total knowledge. So in the Sakya tradition, they talk about the Gunshi Gyugyu, the causal alaya. So what this shows is that the potential for attaining the Buddha's powers and so forth are inherently in this mind, because the mind is an awareness, cognitive, and clarity. And so we can understand how, on the basis of this, we can understand how to attain powers and so forth of a Buddhahood. So this empty nature of the mind, as long as it is defiled, it is called Buddha nature. When it is completely freed from these defilements completely, then we reach Bodhi, the enlightenment, and therefore we have the once we become enlightened Buddha, then we are able to serve other sentient beings effortlessly and spontaneously. And so we have the practice of morality, concentration, and wisdom or insight, and then the 37 harmonies to enlightenment. So these are common foundation. And even in Tantra, we find relating the different mandala parts of mandala to the different practices of the 37 harmonies and so forth. So with regard to the Pali tradition, it spread from India to Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, and so forth. And then the Sanskrit tradition first went to China. First, from India, it went to China. More than 300 or 400 years before it came to Tibet. And then from Tibet, it spread from China, Buddhism spread to Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. And perhaps there may have been direct contact with India as well for these countries. And then in Mongolia, there is an early phase of spread of Buddhism. I don't know the details, but the Sokpo abbot, the Mongolian abbot is here, so he may know better. So this early phase of the dissemination of Buddhism may have taken through the Silk Route, but the Buddhism that they have today, this complete teaching, or the entire teaching of the Buddha, including the basic vehicle, Mahayana in general, and the Tantra that is spread in Mongolia, and came from Tibet. So it spread from Tibet, and so we have these countries which follow the Sanskrit tradition. So Buddhism spread from India to Tibet in the 7th century. So during the time of Songtsen Gampo, the Tibetan emperor. And so before that, this king married a prince from China and a prince of Nepal. And so with these two princesses actually brought two Buddha statues to Tibet with them. So although there was this family relationship, Songtsen Gampo could have taken Buddhism from China, a third country, but then the Tibetan Songtsen Gampo took Buddhism directly from India. So there are two different opinions as to whether Thumi Sambhota actually devised the Tibetan script or he actually improved over what actually existed in the before him. So in any case, Buddhism was brought to Tibet around that 7th century, and then Buddhism spread to Tibet from China during the time of King Tisung Detsen, Tibetan Emperor Tisung Detsen, who invited Guru Padmasambhava, whom we Tibetans refer to as the Guru, Guru Rinpoche, and then Lobun Rinpoche, and then Chandrakshita, whom we refer to as the Kenpo, and then therefore these three personalities are referred to as Kenlopchu, the trio of Kenlopchu, Ken referring to the abbot, Chandrakshita, Lob referring to Lobun Padmasambhava, the guru, and then Chu refers to Chögyal, the Tibetan Dharma king. And so from then on, Buddhism spread, flourished in Tibet. So we have the complete teaching of Buddhism up to the highest yoga tantra. So Chandrakshita was responsible for establishing Buddhism in Tibet. So Chandrakshita has written a text on highest yoga tantra. So it shows that he was practicing tantra. Then he gave monastic ordination, starting with this first 7 novice monks who to test the receptivity of Tibetans for monastic ordination. So some Indian historians say that Chandrakshita was around in his 70s when he went to Tibet, whereas Tibetan historians say that Chandrakshita lived around 1,000 years. And so, but then the Chinese, an Indian historian and scholar told me that Tibetans actually added, Chandrakshita lived around 90, and Tibetans added one more zero, an extra zero, and made it 900. And so we have a remaining body, Chandrakshita's body in Samye. A Tibetan devotee, was able to actually hide a part of Chandrakshita's body, which was preserved in Samye Monastery, and it's still there. So if we can actually use forensic science to check that, we can find perhaps how long Chandrakshita had lived. And so recently, in Tunghang and in Afghanistan, they found some things which were 2,600 years, over 2,600 years old, some relics of Buddha. And so I have been telling since many years that if we could actually check these relics forensically, then perhaps we can find the date of the Buddha. So many of you have heard me saying this before, but Some of you may not have heard. And so, Nagarjuna, Bhava Viveka, Shantideva, and so forth have actually argued that Mahayana is the teaching of the Buddha, is. And then these days also it is happening in Taiwan or in Korea as well. So saying that Mahayana is not a teaching of the Buddha. So they are not to be blamed for that, because Mahayana doesn't seem to have been taught by the Buddha in public. So with regard to the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, even if someone without any religious belief were to be around in the vicinity seeing the Buddha giving teaching, of course, maybe he would be able to see whoever is there, the Buddha giving teaching. But when it comes to giving some teachings, if someone who has no karma, no belief, belief in some kind of spiritual tradition, and I don't know if they can actually see the Buddha giving teaching or not. And then we find in the sutras, there are which mention many different bodhisattvas, such as Manjushri, Vajrapani, Vajramanjushri, Avalokiteshvara, Samanda Bhatra, and so forth. Maitreya and so forth. And so in Heart Sutra we find a dialogue between Sharidotiputra and Avalokiteshvara. So while this dialogue was taking place, if someone without access to Avalokiteshvara with a pure vision, pure karma, someone with a pure vision, without a pure vision to have that kind of vision, were to be present there, it would seem that to that person that Shariputra was actually talking to himself, all by himself. And so, the fact is that the Mahayana teachings were not given in public, and therefore these were not recorded. So in Blades of Reasoning by Bhava Viveka, it is said that the Mahayana teachings were compiled by Manjushri and other deities and not humans. So within the Mahayana teaching, there are teachings which were given in a large assembly, and commonly to many different beings. And then there are others which were given very secretly, the tantric teachings, the esoteric teachings, and particularly the highest yoga tantra. And in general, all the different tantras, and particularly the highest yoga tantra, are given in accordance with the different structure or physiological structure within the practitioners as well. And their interests, the physiological structures, and wind energy, prana energy, and so forth that are flowing in the body. And so accordingly, they were given these different teachings in the highest yoga tantra. The number of different channels and chakras are also found different in different tantras, like Guhyasamaja tantra, and other tantras are different. And so when the practitioners have this kind of pure vision, then through their own spiritual development and progress, then the deities appear to them and then receive the teachings. So these teachings were given to people with pure karma. For example, in the case of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, among the audience, there may be beings, deities from the Pure Land, Amitabha Pure Land, and so forth. Whereas the highest yoga tantra is given for the human beings on this earth who have this kind of body with the six constituent factors. In Nagabodhi's commentary to Namshak Rigpa. He says that this body that we have, of human body, that we have, is something which is even admired by the gods of the Sukhavati land. So this is because, and by using the body that we have now, these channels and the prana energies that flow in them, by using them, we can forcibly actually stop the flow of gross prana energies and also gross workings of gross mind. So the Tibetan Buddhism, which is still extant today, which has the entire teaching of the Buddha, came to Tibet in the 8th century, mainly 8th century, with the help of King Tisong Detsen and Chandrakshita, Master Chandrakshita, and Guru Padmasambhava. And this tradition that we have preserved so far through rigorous study and practice, we study over many years, for many years, by first memorizing the root texts, and also those who are able to, those who have very good memorizing skill, and they also memorize the commentaries, and then we undertake the study of them, and then having studied them, we have had many people who have devoted their life to practice as well. So this teaching of the Buddha, the entire teaching of the Buddha that we have preserved it, promoted, and until now through both study and practice. And so this is only extant in Tibetan Buddhism. Today it is said that there are 400 to 500 million Chinese who are follower of Buddhism, who are following Buddhism. So this is a huge number, about 500 million. And so amongst all the different followers of Buddhism, the only one who preserve Buddhism through study and practice, combining them both, is only us Tibetans. So we, the Tibetan Buddhist, we who uphold the Tibetan Buddhism, are the only ones doing this. So we have to feel proud of ourselves. We can actually study the whole teaching of the Buddha in our own language. We can explain, thoroughly explain in totality, the philosophical views of Buddhism in our language without having to resort to any other language. So, we Tibetans living in different countries must pay attention and take interest in our own language. Learn it. So, if you are interested in Buddhist philosophy, there is no greater language than our own Tibetan language to explain the whole philosophical teachings of Buddhism. Sanskrit is not a living language. And then in other languages, it's still being translated. And so there is great difficulty when they have to rely on a second language. So we have to see this as our treasure, our own language, as our own treasure, and also a treasure or heritage of this world as well. So these, of course, I'm talking things on the side, but then since here is a large gathering, I wish to express or share this to you. So all of us do not want suffering, but we want we don't want suffering. We want happiness, and then amongst different religious traditions, we are the follower of Buddhism, and particularly the Sanskrit tradition, which has come down to us from the Nalanda, and so we are followers of Nalanda tradition. So Buddhism came to Tibet in the 7th century and then established wells in the 8th and 9th centuries. And after that, then Buddhism declined, which is quite sad. And then Tibetans lived rather fragmented state. So in the 7th, 8th, and the early 9th centuries, all Tibetans were united. And some historians, good historians, experts, say that in Tibetan, we refer to Tibet, China, Hor, Mongolia, and Tibet. So, 7th, 8th, 9th centuries, there is Chinese, and in the north is Mongolia, Hor, and then to the south of Mongolia there is Tibet. And so these scholars are saying, using these terms based on Chinese documents. And then after the 9th century, Tibet became fragmented. And so Tibetans were held together, united by Buddhism. And then the descendants of the Tibetan kings, Ngari Chögyal, the chief local chieftain in the western part of Tibet, of course ruled a very small part of Tibet, but they were dedicated to revive Buddhism, which has already spread during the times of their ancestors. And therefore, in order to revive, revive Buddhism in Tibet, they found Vikramalashila, which must have been the one of the main centers of learning of Buddhism in those days. So, of course, they were followers of the Nalanda tradition. So, at that time, in the 11th century, then Vikramalashila was flourishing. Buddhism was flourishing there, and therefore the Ngari Chögyals invited Atisha Dipankara Shijana, as Atisha says in his Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, as requested by the good disciple Changchubu. I've written it, and so. His uncle, the Changchu Wu, went to his uncle, Yeshi Wu, who was imprisoned by Garlok King at the time, when he went in search of gold in order to invite Indian masters. Changchu Wu actually asked if he could actually give a ransom, gold, paid to the Garlok king or ruler in gold, to get him out of prison. He told his uncle that he has got quite a big amount of gold now, but he will actually try to get more gold so that it could be the size of the Changchu Wu himself. And Changchu Wu's reply was that you should put your effort in inviting Adisha Dibankara to Tibet. I trust you to do that, to revive Buddhism in Tibet and progress it, develop it further. And so this is my testament to you. And I have no other wish, and I have only this wish for you. This is what, and you don't need to pay the king of Garlok to get me out of the prison. And so Yeshi told this sobbing. And therefore, Cheng Zhiwu invited Master Atisha, and Master Atisha, when he accepted the invitation, he said that the Tibetan king, especially the Rishi Wu, were bodhisattva, emanations of bodhisattvas, and so I must accept the invitation. And therefore, he accepted the invitation and went to Tibet. And so when Atisha reached Tibet, Tibetans actually received him wearing all kinds of costumes, and even the monks were wearing all kinds of costumes. And Atisha, when he saw them coming to receive them, he actually covered himself with his upper robe. And Cheng Zhiwu asked him, what's the matter? And he said, oh, there are the demons coming towards me. And so then these the dignitaries and the monks and removed these grand costumes, and then invited, received Atisha. And then Atisha started going with them. So we have this costume of wearing all kinds of grand costume. So if you wear something that is called kuepen, at the behind on the back side of this cloth, there is some part, some kind of a bluish patch, which is called talin. Talin means that which actually holds the hair. So if you really want to wear that kuepen, then you need to have long hair. So that's not what we should do as monks. So if we want to be rulers, if we want to be really masters to other people, then we should be actually educated in the three Pitakas. So we have really made mistakes by not being sincere about what we are doing in terms of Dharma practice. So unless we are actually able to acknowledge our own faults, I mean, this kind of things are happen. So when I left Tibet, I brought one. I brought one shirt which has brocade lining on it, and then I had two others which I actually tore off and then used the brocade for the Buddha statue, to make clothes for Buddha statue. And then the namjar that I had made of brocade silk, I actually washed it first and then put it on the Jo Wati Sangpo. And then I made for myself a new namjar, a yellow robe with fabric material. And then with regard to hat, I don't really pay much attention. I'm not so so fond of a grand kind of hats. So I'm not so fond or amazed or with the hats that we wear. But if we look at the Indian masters, like 17 Nalanda masters and so forth, we don't really see them wearing hats. Nalanda masters may not have this tradition of wearing hats. And so since Tibetans began to wear hats, then they also made the same kind of custom to put on hats on Indian masters. Perhaps Jayang Sherpa has written this in his historical account of Vajrabhairava, where he says this. Segyu Master Kunchung Yarnpel, of the Segyu tradition, when he met Staranatha, he actually made a painting of the six masters, the eight masters who were called six ornaments and two sublime masters. And then Segyu Kunchu Yarnpel actually painted these masters on top of there. He put hats, Gelugpa hats. So making these Indian masters like Gelugpa masters. And so, as Gelugpas, for example, we have Lamrim and Lojong tradition, and also the king of Tantra, Guhyasamaja, we should actually be able to show the greatness of Gelug tradition through these practices, and not on the basis of our hats. And so, and because we have emphasized so much on wearing the different hats, we have these names for the different sects of Tibetan Buddhism as yellow hat sect, red hat sect, and so forth. So this is not what we want. So what I wish to say is that Ngari Chögyal had invited Atisha. Now here, with regards to the three stages of meditation, Kamalachala wrote them, these three books, at the request of King, the Tibetan Emperor Tisong Detsen, who ruled the whole of Tibet. Which is one of the three countries that are referred by this term, Gya Hor Pu. Gya for Chinese, China, Hor for Mongolia, and Pu for Tibet. And so, King Tisong Detsen felt determined to request Master Kamalashila to write the three stages of meditation. And then he wrote it. And then so the Kadamba tradition emphasized the practice of Lamrim and the Lojong practices, because around by that time Tantra has been used so much and misused by people. And therefore, to keep the tantric practices secretly, they emphasized the sutra teachings. Around that time, when Adisha came to Tibet, the tantric practitioners despised Vinaya, and the Vinaya practitioners, the monastics who kept the celibacy, and there was a tendency of despising the tantric teachings. So Atisha showed that how to combine both the sutra and the tantra, as it was already established during the time of the kings, ancestral kings of Tibet, like. So Atisha had both the profound and the extensive lineages of the Lamrim. And then so this followed, came down through the three lineages of the Kadam tradition, and then the three Kadam lineages again. Of course, all three lineages comprise both the profound and extensive lineages, but it's a manner of emphasizing to call these three lineages. And then Tsongkhapa received the river of all the transmissions that had come down through these three lineages of Kadam. And so before Master Tsongkhapa, there were texts like Tenrim, Stages of the Doctrine, and other texts that actually teach the stages of the path of enlightenment. So Master Tsongkhapa used these as his basis, and then wrote the called drawn information and called practices from the different treatises. And then they wrote the Lamrim Chemo, and then Lamrim Dingbo, and then the short, concise Lamrim. These three we have already finished last year. So after Adisha wrote the Lamdun, the path, lamp for the path to enlightenment, perhaps there was a Lamrim tradition before that, but Longchen Rinpoche, had written the seven treasuries, in which there is the Yeshinzu, which is like the Lamrim, and especially the Semnying also is exactly like the Lamrim practice. When you go about with the different points of practices, it's similar to Lamrim. I have received teachings on it and received the instructions on this. Semnying also, resting in the nature of the mind. And then in the Sakya tradition, when it comes to teaching on the three visions, it's similar to Lamrim. And Gyusum, the three continuum, continua are like the highest yoga tantra, which is according to the Heyavajra tantra. And then in the Kagyu tradition, we have Marpar Milarepa and Thakpol Haje. And then Thakpol Haje Gampopa wrote the Thakpol Thargyan, the jewel ornament of liberation, which is said to combine the two rivers of Kadam and Mahamudra. And so this actually starts with teaching on Buddha nature, just like as Chijan Rinpoche had told me, the Sharawa has written a text which it starts with the teaching on the Buddha nature. And so all the different Tibetan Buddhist traditions have the same practice of leading disciples through these Lamrim practice, which are meant for the three types of beings. And so the Buddha's teachings are comprised in the three Pitaka. And so we have the Pitaka in the Pali tradition also. And so the content of all these three Pitakas are brought down into the practices pertaining to the three types of beings. And so this Kadam tradition, Dom Tempa has praised that this rosary of the Kadam tradition, which is written, called meant for the three types of beings, and called the teachings which are found in the three Pitakas, will always be beneficial to whoever sends the beads. And so, in order to reach the definite goodness, Nyevaralekpa, the liberation, we need to reach it. We can reach it through by using our intelligence. And therefore, in order to be able to use this kind of intelligence discernment, then we need to have attained a higher rebirth. And therefore, there is teachings on the how to attain higher rebirth and the means to definite goodness. And so faith is used for is the means for higher rebirth, and the definite goodness is attained by means of using our intelligence. intelligence which is which discerns the reality as it is. And then through this, then we have the fivefold path that we tread. And so our objective is to attain the higher rebirth and to the definite goodness. And so as to how to go about with these two practices, Ayadeva has said in his 400 verses, first get rid of the negative non-virtuous actions, and then in the middle, get rid of this grasping itself, and finally destroy all distorted views. And such a person is who is able to do this is wise. And so by restraining ourselves from by refraining ourselves from committing non-virtuous actions, we create the cause for higher rebirth. And then when we add to that the practice of generosity and so forth, it leads us to higher rebirth as well, an excellent higher rebirth. So with regard to grasping at selfhood or self, the second line in Ayadeva's 400 verses, which says in the middle, get rid of self-grasping. So here we can talk refer this to selflessness of persons, in order, which is for the purpose of attaining liberation from afflictive emotions. And then meditation on emptiness is done on the one hand to fulfill the complete purpose. And so for that, we need to cultivate wisdom, realizing both selflessness of persons and selflessness of phenomena. As Tsongkhapa says in his text. So in Tashi Diction, the Ocean of Reasoning, which is a commentary to Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karika, Tsongkhapa has said that we have to know the very emptiness in a great detail by using the very incisive kind of discernment. And so, although selflessness is also taught in the Hinayana texts, and it is the way it is taught in the Mahayana sutras is more extensive, and by using called varieties of reasonings. And so, first, avoid non-meritorious actions. In the middle, get rid of the grasping at self, and then finally, in the end, get rid of the distorted views. Means realizing both selflessnesses, and so the Lama Tsongkhapa's text, The Three Principal Aspects of the Path, goes through the method of turning our mind away from samsara, the four ways of turning our mind away from it. Whereas in the Lamrim text, it goes through these two outlines, developing the aspiration for higher rebirth and showing the means to attain that. So in the second outline, under the second outline comes the teachings on how to gain higher rebirth. The law of karma is taught there. So this is a general presentation. So with regard to the sequence, I think I should start with the refined gold, the essence of refined gold. So chronological order, Ngawantakpa's Gomchen Ngawantakpa's Lamri may have preceded it. So perhaps I should start with the essence of refined gold.
So first we will start with the essence of the refined gold, and first I took the transmission from I've given the first transmission to Khulu Lama Tenzin Kyentso Rinpoche. It was in Bodh Gaya at that time. At that time, Rinpoche told me about this, and I have a dream in my. I have a dream that that someone who claims to be a relative of the third Dalai Lama and who given me a blue scarf. And I told Rinpoche about that event, and Rinpoche says that's a good sign. So inside, I didn't know what's inside, but someone claimed to be a relative of Third Dalai Lama and came to my dream to present it. So I thought there is an auspicious sign for this. And the second Dalai Lama and the third Dalai Lama are one of the greatest masters who spread the Buddhist teaching to the central Tibet, and then to also to the Mongolians and also to the eastern part of Tibet. It is the third Dalai Lama who mainly spread the teachings of the Buddha. And second, it's due to one of the Dalai Lama's texts, so I feel close to it. So actually, the refined gold and the sacred precious words of the Manjushri is a pure commentary of the sutra. So I need to give the commentary simultaneously and together. The sweet part and the sacred word, I got the transmission together. So I thought to do those two together. So first, I will go through with the essence of the refined gold, then the Dabangantabas Lamrim, the verse one, then followed by the sacred word of Manjushri and the sweet part. So actually, it is. The transmission is through the experience way, and actually there is not much difference with the practice experience or the way of the transmission given. But the main reason is that it should be benefiting to the practice. So whatever the transmission that is given in a day, so once you return back to your home at night, so you must go through it, read through it, and also the preparatory texts. So even though you may not have time to do all the preparatory rituals and the texts, but you can visualize your masters and their Lama in a few seconds, instantly, and with the Lama Tsongkhapa and all the other masters, having visualized all the great masters. So and as whenever the at the end of the day when the teaching stops and go through it. So when normally we pay more importance to the recitation of the text. So when the recitation becomes too long, as the Agusharab Jesu has stated in the commentary of the Vajrabhairava, that actually once having recited the ritual text, when the actual time come, it is the time to concentrate about the generation stage and the deep and the extensive paths. And if you are not able to meditate all this, then we can rely upon the recitation of the mantras. But now, we are focusing and paying more important to the recitation of the mantras, but rather the main actual practice of the deities and visualization is not paying that much importance. So therefore, if we are lacking in that part, so we are considering the recitation of the mantra as more important. So once if you're too tired, then we have to just stop the session. There is no other way. During the visualizing of the deities, and if you are tired with all those visualizations and the practices, then as for the resting yourself, one need to do the recitation of mantra. But we are paying more important on the recitations of the mantra, and after the once we are tired, you feel like urinating, going for toilets. So there is no other way than stopping and concluding the session. So we're considering the importance to the recitation of the text, but the real important or concentrating upon the meaning is neglected. So even though you can do the recitation of the words by mouth, but the important thing is we need to understand the meaning. The meaning has to rely upon the words. So the important thing is one need to meditate and visualize and concentrate upon the meaning. And while doing his meditation and doing prayers, he used to do it two times and the three times. And he used to say that even though the recitation comes by my mouth by itself, as I'm used to it, but when I get distracted, then I do it again so that I can focus and concentrate upon it, which is really very practical and good. And Khyentrum Rinpoche also said in one of his said that he didn't recite through his mouth and the words, but he just visualized in his mind and thinking about all the processes and everything. So even if you are not able to meditate or visualize everything, but just mentally, if you think one by one, everything mentally, even though sometimes I try to do it, it's more difficult because you need really your all concentration. But if you just recite through mouth, you can look here and there, and because your mouth keeps on moving, but you are not able to concentrate completely on the topic. So the main point that I'm trying to tell you is that at the end of the day, it's very important that you need to think about all the teachings, the orders and the sequence every day. So it's not just a transmission that you have heard and it's completed. The main purpose is about purpose is for generating your mind and for the enlightenment. So even during the teaching, one need to practice and think as much as possible and try to focus upon it. And from now on, so I think it's already 11:30 now, so I will just start a bit. The essence of refined gold. An explanation on the stages of the path to enlightenment. At your feet, my precious master, great being, who include three jewels, with great veneration I bow and go for refuge. I pray you to bless me. Page number 111, The Pearl Garland, New and Revised Edition. The present book explains how the beings who wish to take full advantage of their lives with freedom and fortune are to practice. What is known as the stages of the path to enlightenment is the essence of the conqueror's entire teaching. The unique path traveled by all Aryas of the three times, the tradition of the two great trailblazers. When we say the lamp for the path to enlightenment, is when we speak about the path. So path is the state or which brings you to the highest realizations and the state of enlightenment. And it is a means or it's a means to which brings you to that state. But when we speak about path, we should be referring it to our own mental state, which always desire happiness and do not desire unhappiness. The one which is always under the influence of the afflicted emotions, and that which has the potential to change to become free from all these afflictions. So once we are able to generate such a mind for liberations, so one should be work hard towards the generation of the understanding of no-self. So once having the basic understanding of no-self, so the understanding develops further into direct realizations of the no-self. And gradually, the path of seeing, directly seeing the true comes. And as we normally recite in the Heart Sutra, that gone, that's gone, and the gade gade. So as the phrase from the Heart Sutra recites, one should be able to visualize oneself in terms of Mahayana, that one is under the influence of all these afflicted emotions, and one should visualize in such a way that one's own mental state or being is being progressing from the lower path to the senior and the higher path. So this is very important that we have to think every day. So there is not much explanations needed here. So third paragraph in this regard, first note that the religious system of excellent beings traveling toward the state of complete omniscience, that includes all the steps without exception to be practiced by the three kinds of beings. In this regard, first note that the teaching to be practiced is one whose source is utterly pure. The teaching which originates from a pure source must not be lacking. It should be complete and unmistaken and include all aspects of the path to enlightenment. The source of the present learning that I will implement is pure, for it originated in the utterly complete Buddha and was progressively transmitted in the lineage including the two masters, Nagarjuna and Asanga. The graduated teaching that derives from such a stainless source is like a wish-granting gem, for it radiantly fulfills all the aspirations of sentient beings. It resembles a great ocean combining all streams of good explanations without exception, the excellent scriptures of both the greater and lesser vehicles. When we speak about as a means to transform one's own mind. In the great text, we have the first presenting one's own system, then refuting the other system, and then refuting all the debates and arguments related to it. But here, it's not that extensive here. It's presented in a concise manner. It is something that can be practiced easily. And Lama Tsongkhapa explains very seriously in the great treatise on the path to enlightenment that there is not a teaching that is to be imparted to others and something that is to be practiced. So this, if we consider these two as different things, unrelated things, then it is really a great mystic. From the path of accumulation to the great omniscience, the path that leads to that. So all the teachings are concluded in the direct discourse or the two canons, 200 canons of 100 canons of Kanjur and the two or 200 canons of Tenkur, the translation discourses. So apart from this great text of the Buddhas, then if we look for another source of teaching to be as one practice, that is not the true instructions. What the instruction here means is not something that is being whispered or passed from one ear to the other, but the real instruction is something which possesses all the essence and the nectars, which is presented in all the great texts and can be collectively summarized as a means to practice for one's own sake, which is, this is called instructions. In the Paramita texts and the sutras, all the practices and all the everything has been present in a very extensive manner. But one should be able to combine and summarize all those essence and practices into one form which can be used to practice and which is called instructions. So even though you are very much trained in the instructions, but if you are not able to gain the understanding of the great text, then maybe it's your own fault, or maybe the instruction So in that cases, of course, you must leave your instructions, but one is never allowed to leave the great text. So many people here feels that, oh, I do not really understand the great text, so I need a very summarized instructions. So that may be also considerable, and it's quite something good. I met someone from China recently. And some masters and lamas who come from Tibet to China to give teachings. And he is someone who presents all the essence of the paths and which can be meditated. And one of the students of that master met another Chinese. And that Chinese devotee, and the master who gives the teaching in the sequence and orderly, and he came wanted to give the to receive the teaching. After the teaching concludes, he says that your teacher, when I receive your teachings, I need to think a lot, I need to contemplate a lot, and there's a lot of things to do. When I take teaching from my guru, there is not so much vogue related, and I can easily take it. My teacher says that I will bring you to the state of enlightenment. Bring me money, give me money, and I will bring you directly to the enlightenment. So this is really a disgrace, and this is really a bad example. So there are such cases that you do not need those texts, you do not need to study. I will give you a unique instructions which will bring you directly to the state of enlightenment. So these are really a very dangerous sport. And we have to be very careful about such instructions. Lama Tsongkhapa says that, apart from Lord Buddha, who else is there who can give the supreme instructions? So whatever he teaches is the real instructions. So even though it may be very extensive and may not be accommodable to, may not be proper to one's mental state, but through such texts of Lamrim, we should be able to draw the essence of this great text. So therefore, one should never neglect the contents of the great text. Because if we do that, we will gain a lot of negativities, karmas out of it, and it will also result in the decrease of the Buddha's teaching in this world. So including two masters, Nagarjuna and Asanga. This graduated teaching that derives from such a standard source is like a witch granting gem, for it readily fulfills all the aspirations of sentient beings. In a spiritual song, my master said, crown jewels of all the world sages, banners of fame represent among beings, Nagarjuna and Asanga, from whom we will transmit in succession the stages of path to enlightenment. This instruction, which fulfills all beings' goals without exception, resembles thus a rich granting gem, uniting the streams of 1,000 good scriptures. It is an ocean of glorious and excellent words as well. As it is endowed with four aspects of greatness, this instruction far surpasses all others. By relying upon these instructions among the multitude of concrete scriptures, you will understand that some were taught as major aspects of it, while others are auxiliaries to it. And after all, either directly or indirectly, serve as a means for any given individual to realize Buddhahood. So this is speaking purely in form of sutra practice. Even in Lamrim Chemo, when I speak about the practicing upon the general practices, and then specifically in particularly practicing upon the Vajrayana, so the practicing of the great extensive sutra part is spoken differently from the practice of the Vajrayana. It allows you to completely alter the false notion that the scriptures, sutras, and the tantras, and their valid explanatory commentaries simply comprise the material to be studied in depth and explained to others, and that the essential teaching to be practiced is found elsewhere. You come to see that the entire subject matter of the scriptures and their commentaries is contained in the stages of the path, starting with the way to rely on the spiritual masters, and continue on to meditative serenity and spiritual insight, and you consider them to be your core practice. You see them as practical instructions that slow that show how to meditate analytically on the topics to be analyzed and to engage in concentration meditation on those to be focused upon. Page number 113. When you have discerned in this way, you will understand that all Buddhist votes are either direct or indirect means to achieve Buddhahood, apprehending some as guides to Buddhahood that call for application while perceiving others as obstacle to Buddhahood that require rejection is an act of abandoning the teaching. Thanks to the present instruction, by simply assenting that all teachings are free of contradiction as explained above, you automatically avoid the grave misdeed of rejecting the Dharma. Given it is endowed with the four aspects of greatness explained above, those who possess the intelligence to penetrate the significance of scriptures or who wish to acquire it cannot help but delight in the states of the path of the three kinds of beings. To quote Jerome Che, as it allows one to realize that all the teachings are free of contradictions, to recognize all scriptures and instructions, to easily discern the concrete main principles, and to be guarded from the abyss of grave misdeeds, it is the supreme instruction followed by countless fortunate beings, the sages of India and Tibet. What intelligent person will then not delight in the stages of the path of the three kinds of beings? If explaining the instruction with the four aspects of greatness, the stages of the path of the three kinds of beings, which contains the essence of all the concrete words, be it for a single session, carries great advantages. What is to be said of doing so in its entirety? Thus contemplate the benefits and this way generate respect for the teacher and teaching by accurately elucidating to people who are suitable recipients with pure thoughts and behavior. You draw the considerable advantage of correctly explaining the teaching. So I will stop here for lunch break.